Such a great song, such great truths. We are in Mark chapter 15, and we are getting very, very close to the end of this book. It's crazy to me. But hope this time in Mark has been an encouragement. So we are coming to the time where Jesus is crucified. And we're going to partly cover that this morning in Mark chapter 15. And we'll read starting here in just a couple minutes. Have you noticed that Jesus is turning conventional wisdom on its head? He started this really, I guess probably the one of the greatest ways that he started this or introduced this was during the Sermon on the Mount, where he basically said, up is down, down is up, the good times are not so good, suffering is good. And can you imagine just how mind-boggling that would have been for the people that heard it. Jesus, of course, had been telling his disciples about, he had been speaking everywhere about the kingdom, and of course they began to recognize that he is the king, he is the Messiah, and yet they didn't truly understand what he was saying, so much so that just a couple passages ago, when Jesus was being arrested, Peter, you know, somehow he gets a sword. I don't know if he pulled it out of someone else's sheath or how he got it. But you remember that when he basically tried to, well, he attacked one of the servants of the high priest. And so Jesus essentially says, listen, Peter, you are going about this completely the wrong way. And now when we get to the cross, I got to tell you, through the cross, Jesus turns mankind's wisdom on its head. Because, okay, the Jewish people, they expected, you know, this strong and mighty Messiah that would come and conquer their enemies. You know, how is it? There was no way that the true Messiah would ever go to the cross. But then even from the Greek perspective, I mean, they looked at the cross as foolishness. It was something that was despicable. I mean, you wouldn't bring up the cross in a polite conversation. I mean, no one just like, you know, eating dinner around the table, that no one would bring up the cross. I mean, it's like me and you talking about, you know, death by injection or the electric chair. I mean, we just wouldn't talk about those things. But Jesus, as we see here in this passage, he turns the wisdom of mankind on its head. But it also exposes the deep need that mankind has. In fact, in this passage, you know, as people are coming up to Jesus and mocking him and ridiculing him, we see mankind just spewing forth everyone from the Roman soldiers to the Jewish elite people to just the passerbys, those that pass by Jesus. I mean, in this passage, they are just spewing forth their hatred of Jesus and their resentment of Jesus. And I tell you what, I think it's important for us to see this because it really shows us the condition of the heart of mankind. I know we're coming into this Christmas season, and you know, we think about Christmas as being warm and, you know, just a sentimental time, and I hope that it is for a lot of us. But when we think about what Christmas is all about, the fact that you and I as mankind were so desperate that God Himself had to come and pay our debt, that we couldn't redeem ourselves. We were so desperate that God had to come in our place. And so we'll see this here as mankind, as they're spewing forth. And yet, contrary to the wisdom of man, God takes the greatest crime in all of history and through that crime brings about redemption for people like me and you. I mean, who would have come up with this whole storyline? I mean, no one on earth would have come up with this. And so let's go ahead and start here in our passage, and we'll pick up here in just a second. Arlington Auto and Truck Wrecking has long fought with thieves breaking in to steal car parts. But just recently, just this last month, they finally caught one. And they discovered this man, he was inside a car, and evidently he was going to steal some parts, and he had come there and stolen stuff before, but they weren't able to catch him. And so here he is, he's passed out in this car, and before he can get out, the forklift driver comes to the car, and he lifts the car about 20 feet in the air. Now, how many of us, like, we see something like that, and it just kind of warms our hearts. Anyone here besides me? You see something like that. In fact, one of the employees, they called 911, and they explained things. And in this conversation, they said, we've got a guy that's passed out passed out in one of our vehicles in our yard. He says, I've got the vehicle picked up with the loader. He says, I refuse to drop this thing and let him out and run. And the operator, the dispatcher said, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. He says, we'll get someone out to you. Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, it seems like so much passes crime happens. And so to see something like this happen, it's like, man, that is absolutely awesome. Now, we come to a passage like this. You know what this story does as we see Jesus is crucified? Something we said a couple weeks ago, when Jesus went through an illegal trial and he is tried and he is sentenced to death, it is the best of the best that comes forward. And if anything, in condemning an innocent man, by doing so, we condemned ourselves. Now, I love this statement here by Ray Stedman. He says, the cross has a strange and marvelous way of penetrating beneath the surface of our lives, bringing out, first of all, the hidden wisdom of God and wrenching forth our hidden sin and shame. Now, what do we find in this passage? Notice in verse number 20, we'll start here. verse number 16. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters. And by the way, some of these locations, not totally sure exactly where these are, you know, in modern excavation and what we know. We don't know where all these locations are specifically within Jerusalem. But brought him to the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak and twisted together a crown of thorns, and they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. "Hail, King of the Jews," striking him, spitting on him, all of these things. So the Roman soldiers, as they receive Jesus, they begin to make a complete mockery of Jesus, draping on him this royal robe, a purple robe. And of course, in this day, you know, purple is very expensive. It's a very expensive and prestigious dye that would have been used, and it symbolized royalty. They place a crown of thorns on Jesus, woven from an acanthus plant. And then they take a staff, a reed, much like a bamboo stalk, and they strike Jesus repeatedly. And we're not going to go heavily into all the details on all of these things, but, you know, we might wonder by reading this, okay, why is it, okay, we understand the the Jewish leaders and their hatred of Jesus, but why is it when, you know, Jesus is put in the hands of these Roman soldiers, why is it that they just spew forth this hatred of Jesus? I mean, Roman soldiers in this day, you know, it's been pointed out, they could crucify someone in the morning and then go to breakfast and really think nothing of it. You know, they're just hardened, they're professionals, and so, you know, why is it that that this is spewing forth? You know, there's been different suggestions. One man says this, that savagery begets savagery. You know, like when there's blood in the water, it sends sharks into a feeding frenzy. Except I don't know that that's exactly what's going on here. Why is it that the Roman soldiers are mocking Jesus the way that they are? And Ray Stedman points out this. He says the Jews were difficult for the Romans to govern because they were a proud and freedom-loving people. Now think about this. They were continually chafing under Roman rule, so when this Jew fell into their hands, the soldiers lost control. And so all of this, this hatred of the Jewish people, if we want to call it hatred, or this, they're just sick and tired of the Jewish people chafing under Roman rule. And so when the king of the Jews is presented before them, they just lose all control. Now, crucifixion, specifically, it was regarded as the most cruel and horrifying punishment. James Edwards writes, every totalitarian regime needs a terror apparatus, and crucifixion was Rome's terror apparatus ad horrendum, infamous alike for its infliction of pain and disgrace on the victim. In fact, you know, crucifixion, you know, it really wasn't just killing someone's body. In this shame culture, it was like destroying their name. I didn't know this, but, so, you know, we think about Jesus, you know, he was taken to a place called Golgotha, and you know, he was crucified there along with two thieves. But did you know that it was very common, for people to be crucified on roadways? And the reason why is they wanted, like, maximum exposure. It was a very shameful act. It was reserved for the lowest and most defenseless classes, and men were normally crucified naked. And again, it wasn't just destroying their body, it was destroying their name. And just right here, I find it interesting because, again, this is the wisdom of God at work. Because God essentially, he came down from the highest point down to the lowest point. He who deserved the best took the worst for me and for you. And could we say it this way, that he became nameless on the cross so that we might have a name in him? He gave us a name. He gave us his own name as he is crucified in shame, nameless and naked on the cross. Death on the cross, it was painful, prolonged, often lasting for several days. And it was for this reason, the shame and the cross, that Paul, some 25 years later, he would write in 1 Corinthians 1, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to the Gentiles." So it was shameful. The Roman soldiers spewing out their hatred. Notice in verse number 21, "And they compelled the passerby of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross." You say, man, why is it that this specific person, along with their sons, is named here in this passage? Well, the book of Mark was actually written to the Romans. And so it's thought potentially that that these two young men were in the church at Rome. And so he says, oh yeah, it's the father of Alexander and Rufus. We don't know for sure, but that's the potential. Verse number 22. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, so 9 o'clock in the morning, and the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews," and with him they crucified two robbers. Now, what's interesting, the word robber and the word revolutionary, it's interchangeable. We don't know exactly what the crimes were for these guys, but they're called robbers here, one on the right and one on the left. Did I get ahead of myself here? Yeah, they crucified with him two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. Well, according to the law, the guilty had to carry his own cross, and so Jesus, that's exactly what happens here with Jesus. Jesus leaves Pilate's hall so weak, possibly because of the blood loss from being flogged. And of course, that process, Jesus would have been whipped and, you know, with various things at the ends of those whips, everything from bone to glass to metal to whatever they could put on the end of those. And again, potentially from the blood loss from that process, he is so weak at this point where they find this guy that's walking along the way, Simon of Cyrene, and they enlist him to carry the cross of Jesus. They arrive at Golgotha, and again, we don't know exactly what location this was, but the place of the skull. And Mark's readers have probably all witnessed crucifixion, so Mark, just like the other gospel writers, they really don't go into detail here. And the emphasis in the book of Mark is not so much on the crucifixion itself as it is the mockery that Jesus endures through this process. And as customary, there's a placard, and one source told me that the person, the accused, would actually wear this placard as they're going to the cross, and then finally, when they are placed on the cross, the placard would be placed above the offender. And so, with Jesus, you know, King of the Jews, his so-called crime is placed on that placard. The soldiers gamble for his garments, and this, of course, is fulfilling prophecy. Two robbers are placed beside Jesus. The Bible says that Jesus would be numbered with the transgressors. Jesus is offered, as is customary, the women would come out with a narcotic potion to help deaden the pain. But Jesus refused. And I know I'm going through some of the details here kind of quick. There's significance behind every detail, even in this where Jesus refuses this narcotic that's offered to him. Jesus wants to be totally present as he is being offered to God for the sins of mankind. But I think there's something else interesting happening here. And we'll look at this here a little bit more in just a few minutes, but you know, the Bible tells us that when Jesus was reviled, he did not revile in return. When Jesus suffered, he didn't threaten. And even in this little detail here of not receiving this painkiller, Jesus in this time on the cross, he would be so present-minded, and his heart would still be on other people. He would be so present-minded to where the two thieves on the cross, as they are both mocking Jesus, but then as one experiences a change of heart toward Jesus. Do you remember what the thief on the cross said to Jesus? He says, "Jesus, remember me. Remember me when you come to your kingdom." And Jesus is so present-minded. What did he say to that man on the cross? He says, "Today you will be with me in paradise. Do you see, even there is significance even behind these little details. And I find it interesting that Jesus, while he is on the cross, he's not thinking about himself. He's thinking about others. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in just a few minutes. But what I'd like for us to see here, in fact, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Notice in verse number 29. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with their scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Do we see something ironic here? In fact, Mark is a very ironic writer, and he wants us to see the irony. One man said it this way: there are several clues that Mark intends the trial and crucifixion to be understood as a royal enthronement of Jesus as the Messiah. Except you notice here, Jesus is not on a throne, he's on a cross. The royal robe, the crown of thorns. The mockery as people pass by, "Hail, King of the Jews," even bowing down before Jesus. Except, again, Jesus is not on a throne as we would expect. He is on a cross. Do we see here why Jesus is being mocked? And do you notice something? Jesus is not being mocked on the cross because of the Sermon on the Mount. He's not being mocked on the cross because he is a moral teacher. In fact, we've said it before. You know, either Jesus is who he says he is the Messiah, he is God come in the flesh, or he is a complete lunatic. You can't be somewhere in the middle. And if you notice the statements that they've made here regarding the claims of Jesus. Okay, if you're the king, if you're the Messiah, okay, you're supposedly going to come here and save people? Okay, yeah, you've saved others. Now save yourself. Come down off the cross. Do you remember when Jesus was in this illegal trial? And finally, he says to them, he answers beyond their question, and he, pointing back to the Old Testament, essentially says, "Listen, I am God. You're judging me right now, but there's coming a day where the tables are going to be turned, and I am going to be judging you. I will be back." If they understood it, you said that you would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. If they understood it, Jesus was saying, I am going to replace the temple. So do you see the claims that they are mocking? Jesus is not being mocked because he's simply a moral teacher. He is being mocked because of the claims that he has made. The claim to be the Messiah, the claim to replace the temple, the claim to be God himself. And you say, "Pastor Mike, this is a very positive message so far. Man, I'm so thankful. You know, we just had Thanksgiving, and Pastor Mike, you sure know how to bring, like, you know, a really heartwarming message." Oh, man. I wish this was heartwarming. We'll get to a little bit later, but let me ask you. Does this passage, does this response of the people tell us anything about humanity? Does it tell us about our own hearts? There is just something about mankind that we hate the claims of Jesus Christ. There is something in the hearts of mankind where we want to have our own way. And you could look in the book of Psalms, the second Psalm, and see how the peoples of the earth, the kingdoms of the world, the rulers of the world look back at God and say, we do not want you to have us rule over us. How many of us have seen, probably over the past 20 years or so, that there's been a lot of books that have that are trying to discover the real Jesus. Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, if you don't know about it, there's books out there. And the whole idea of these books, so many of them, is, you know, the Jesus of the Bible cannot possibly be the real historical Jesus. Have you seen that kind of stuff? Okay, just take my word for it. There's all kinds of stuff like that. And there are people that have completely devoted themselves to, for example, studying the New Testament, and yet they don't believe in Jesus. Like, they've given their lives to studying the New Testament, and yet they are not convinced that the way that the New Testament conveys Jesus is really historically accurate. And I find this interesting. There's a lot of things that I would disagree with Anne Rice on, but there was a time for Anne Rice, who is a novelist, she would write a book about Jesus Christ. And in doing so, and she was an unbeliever for the longest time, didn't believe in the Jesus as recorded in the Gospels. And again, I wouldn't come to the conclusions that she came to at the end of her life, but I think she says something interesting. Because in a statement, when she wrote her book about Jesus Christ, notice this, what she says. The whole case for the non-divine Jesus who stumbled into Jerusalem and somehow got crucified by nobody and had nothing to do with the founding of Christianity, she says in her studies about the early New Testament times, she says that case was not made. Not only was it not made, she says, I discovered in this field some of the worst and most biased scholarship I'd ever read. And I had also sensed something else. Many of these scholars who apparently devoted their lives to New Testament scholarship, disliked Jesus Christ. Some pitied him as a hopeless failure, others sneered at him, and some felt an outright contempt. I'd never come across this kind of emotion in any other field of research, at least not to this extent. It was puzzling. In general, scholars don't spend their lives in the company of historical figures whom they openly despise, but there are New Testament scholars who detest and despise Jesus Christ. Now, again, I wouldn't come to the same conclusions that she came to at the end of her life, but don't you find it interesting that someone, so many of whom look into and study out who is the historical Jesus, they have already come to their conclusion before their study begins. Does this show us anything about mankind? I'll never forget a statement by, I believe his name is George Wald, received the Nobel Prize for his studies in biology, the professor of biology at Harvard. He said this. He says, evolution has been disproven. He says it was disproven 120 years ago. But he says the only alternative to evolution is God. But he says, I don't want to believe God. So I've chosen to believe what's impossible. Spontaneous life arising from lifeless. Do we see something here about mankind? Do we see something in our own hearts? Is there something in our hearts that says, God, I do not want you to rule over me? Or as the poet wrote, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Notice in verse number, is this our first point or second point? It's our first. By the way, don't get nervous about my next 2 points, okay? We've covered most of the ground in the message. Here's the first point. the cross of Jesus reveals the hostility of man against God. And we see here as people are mocking Jesus as he is on the cross. The cross of Christ reveals the hostility of man against God. Notice again in verse number 29. We read this just a moment ago. I'd like for us to read this again. Verse number 29. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads, saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. These guys, just like me and you, know how a story is supposed to end. We know when we watch a movie, we know even if it's the last few minutes, if it's a Hallmark movie, maybe in the last 30 seconds. But we know that victory is finally coming the whole time that we're watching that movie, the whole time that we're reading the story, the time that we're, you know, someone is telling us a story and we're like, man, I know it's coming. And these guys that are crucifying Jesus, they know how stories go. And they look at Jesus and they say, "You're the hero. Now's the time, Jesus. If you're going to come off the cross, then now is the time." And yet, how contrary the wisdom of man is to the wisdom of God. Because Jesus did not show his heroism by coming off the cross. He showed his heroism by staying on it. And Jesus, as these people are walking by, in spite of his claims of being the Messiah, the Son of God, as these people are ridiculing him, what they don't know is that Jesus is purchasing our redemption through the cross. Jesus is doing the greatest work, the greatest good that this world would ever see. And again, Jesus turns the wisdom of mankind on its head. 1 Corinthians 1, "For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but to us which are saved, it is the power of God." And notice our second point, God's wisdom confounds man's wisdom. It confounds man's wisdom. Not only does this show us the heart of mankind and the natural inclination of man's heart, it also shows mankind, "Hey, Jesus, now's the time. Hey, man, you know, we're getting, the movie's over. The movie's over. Jesus, you're still on the cross." And it shows how God's wisdom totally turns mankind's wisdom on its head. James Edwards writes this, "In this haunting picture of Jesus, fastened to a cross and assailed in mockery, we see proof of the amazing difference between God's way and everything which men consider their goal or conceive of as being God's way." Does this maybe hint at the fact that you and I in our lives, that we shouldn't just see life the way that mankind sees it, but rather we should live it from God's perspective, from his vantage point, from his wisdom? The greatest work that the world has ever seen on the cross. God's wisdom confounds man's wisdom. But you know what? This also teaches us, I think that there's something that you and I can take away personally from this, that even for me and you as Christians, or maybe even an unbeliever here this morning, if you are examining Christianity and you're trying to figure out, okay, what makes this tick? Weakness in our own lives often causes us to mock God. And we endure trials and afflictions, blow after blow, and we look back at God and we say, a loving God, yeah, right. You know, how is it that I could be going through all of this? I mean, how is it that there could be a loving and a sovereign God who is ruling over all things and I am going through all of this, whatever trial, whatever circumstance that might be? And from our perspective, often our perspective is we can run our lives better than God. And yet, what an example Jesus is. Because Jesus here on the cross, When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. Jesus remains a channel of grace, totally present-minded, ready to minister to the thief next to him. Do you remember that statement that Jesus cries out from the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they what? They know not what they do." How is it that Jesus can endure all of these things and yet still remain gracious, still remain forgiving? And I ask this for me personally, you know, how is it? Because I don't know about you, like especially when I'm hurting, that's the time where I tend to hurt other people more. Are you with me on that? You know, they say that hurting people hurt people. And so the last thing that seems to come naturally from Mike Rogers when I'm in the middle of pain and when, you know, when I'm really going through something is not grace. You know, I'm going through difficulty. The last thing that I'm thinking of is ministering to someone else. And yet, what do we see here on the cross? Jesus is doing exactly that in the darkest moment of his life. Recently in Brazil, a hailstorm was happening. And at the same time, a symphony orchestra performance. And the orchestra here, I'll throw a picture. This is when the lights are on, okay? This is the orchestra. But when the storm, it was during this storm that the storm caused a power outage. And it was a total of about 45 seconds, I think it was, two different breaks in the power until ultimately the backup generator came on fully to where this orchestra, you know, had light again. But what was interesting about the power going out was that this orchestra stayed playing the entire time. Now, I don't know about you, but that's kind of cool. You know, if I'm up here playing the guitar, and if my iPad goes dead, guess what? I'm not playing any music for you. But these guys, they know their music so well. The conductor felt, he said, that there was no other option but to continue. He says this, "I believe the musicians thought the same. The moment during the concert was really fun. I thought, let's see until which measure of the music the orchestra continues playing, and they didn't stop." Now, that's kind of cool. Now, I won't say that this is fun, but what we see in Jesus Christ is when the lights went out, he continued playing. And even in his relationship with Jesus, you know, man, so often for me and for you, for humanity, I'll just say it that way. When things don't go in my life the way that I want them to, what is our natural response? "God, I'm done with you. I'm just forget it." Jesus, even when God the Father turned his back on his son because he cannot look at sin, Jesus did not lose that relational aspect. He still cried out, "My God, my God." Is it possible for me and for you to stay faithful when the lights go out? Is it possible for me and you to experience grace and even to show other people grace? You know what I find interesting is that for so many that have gone through difficulties in their life, and God has used that difficulty to minister to them, to build them up, to show him to show them his grace, that there are some people, they've gone through horrendous things in their life, and you know what I've seen? As God has built them up, they become some of the most grace-filled people that I have ever met. And it doesn't make sense. You know why that is? The grace of God doesn't make sense. And if you're here this morning, and if God has brought you through difficulty, I am sure that many in here could give testimony where you would say, "You know what? I went through difficulty beyond my imagination. And the only way that I can explain how I was sustained during that time is that there was a grace, there was something supernatural. God was giving me his grace because it didn't come from me. And I sustained during those times, and I even came out stronger. And I think it's all because there comes a point where, just like Jesus did on the cross, he cast himself on the strength of God the Father. And I think maybe as an example for us, he wants us to come to that place as well where we say, you know what, if this is going to work, it's not going to be because of any resources that I have. The only option, how many of us have been here? The only option that I have left is to cast myself on the strength of God himself. And difficult times could either make you hardened against God. Oh yeah, loving God. Yeah, right. Or it can bring me to the place where I am softer and I cast myself at the feet of Jesus. It's been said that the same sun that melts the wax hardens the clay. Which one are you? Difficult times, testings, doesn't make sense to me why God would bring this in my life. It seems illogical. But you know what? I'm going to cast myself on Jesus. Or is it a loving God? No way. I'm done. You know, the truth is, as we see here in the example of Jesus, who did not live and minister in his own strength, but he says, all that I do, it is the Father doing through me. Could you and I say the same, even through difficult times? God's grace enables me to respond patiently like Jesus. And I just got to think that when Paul later, he was enduring a thorn in the flesh, that maybe, just maybe, he prayed three times that God would take this thorn in the flesh away. And God said no. He says, and if you bring the quote up here, God said, my grace is sufficient for you. I'm sorry, not the quote, the verse. Do I not have that? I might not have it. 2 Corinthians, okay, there we go. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Is it possible that when Paul was enduring that thorn in the flesh, as he called it, that maybe he thought about the crown of thorns that Jesus endured? My grace is sufficient. God's grace enables me to respond patiently like Jesus did. Are you going through some kind of a trial, some kind of a circumstance? Something that just seems to be lasting forever? Thank God it was as Jesus turned the wisdom of man on its head. It is through the very cross itself that I am enabled to go through circumstances patiently like Jesus did. God, we are thankful for this passage and for the truths that we see here. God, we thank you for going to the cross for mankind. We thank you for enduring to the very end. It would have made sense for mankind for you to come off the cross, but as mankind was spewing forth its heart toward you, you showed your heroism not by coming off the cross, but by staying on it. And God, you purchased our redemption. God, we thank you for the new life that we have in you. God, we thank you for your enabling grace that helps us through difficulties, sustains us, enables us to carry through during the most difficult circumstances. God, I pray that you would help us to rest 100% on you. Let me ask you a couple questions this morning. Are you resting entirely on Jesus? Have you given your life to him, looked to him for eternal life, called out on him? Jesus, I look to you and you alone for salvation. If you've never done that, even here in this moment, just right where you're sitting, I would encourage you, as God works on your heart, if you've never called out for him, the salvation that is available in Jesus Christ alone, I would encourage you, call out to him. God, thank you for dying on the cross and I look to you for my salvation. I wonder if you're here this morning and maybe you're going through a difficult time. I don't know. But you know what? It is through the cross that not only God purchased our redemption, but it is through the cross that we receive the grace that we need to live patiently day by day, to be able to stay up during the difficulties of life. And that grace is available to every single one of us. And maybe even in these moments, you might want to cast your care before God and make a renewed commitment to cast yourself on Jesus and his strength to get you through whatever you might be going through right now. God, you are good and you are faithful. God, we thank you for purchasing our redemption and for giving us the grace that we need day by day and moment by moment to live a grace-filled life, to be able to be sustained, but to live a grace-filled life even in difficult circumstances. God, we are thankful. It is possible only by what you have done for us. God, I pray that you would help us. I pray that we would continue to look to you. God, we thank you most of all for the salvation that you purchased on the cross for us. I pray that your gospel would turn our hearts to you. God, we're thankful. And I pray this in Jesus' name.